The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. It's Indie Week, the Independent. I'm John Feddersen here with you for our last issue before the Christmas holidays, and it's dated December the 18th of 2025. Sounds Christmassy, doesn't it, that music? No. Okay, let's get going on our issue. First, from Durham. Durham is expanding its shelter options for these frigid winter nights. On the coldest nights of the year, while many of us snuggle up in the comfort of our homes with hot cocoa, hoping to glance outside and see snowfall, some of our neighbors are searching desperately for ways to keep themselves and loved ones warm as they brace for frigid temperatures. This winter, Durham will nearly quadruple the number of beds available for people on white flag nights, which occur when temperatures are forecast to be at or below 32 degrees. Or 35 degrees if there's rain or snow. At the same time, local organizations are collaborating on a new initiative this winter called 100 Days of Warmth. That's a campaign to raise awareness about these white flag shelters and to raise funds to expand shelter capacity and other homelessness services further. Ryan Smith, Director of Community Safety with the City of Durham, says, they hope to encourage other churches and advocacy groups, many of whom are members of the city's Continuum of Care network, to join in the mission. Smith says, I think a lot of people in Durham really care about this. A lot of people want Durham to be a place where everyone has a safe, warm place to sleep on the coldest nights. According to Housing for New Hope, that's a nonprofit focused on outreach and rehousing, about 381 people are homeless in Durham, slightly down from 2024. But 51% of Durham's homeless population is unsheltered. That's a 12% uptick from the previous year, heightening the demand for temporary and long-term options. Starting this week, over 70 new beds will become available for folks in need, a bulk of which will be the school building owned by Union Baptist Church. Previously, urban ministries and families moving forward have been able to offer only a handful of beds. Durham Rescue Mission also has limited availability, but those numbers are harder to track because the Rescue Mission is not part of the city's Continuum of Care, which is a network of nonprofits and local organizations that collaborate with the city and county on homelessness services. Kitty Telemach, lead organizer at Durham Congregations, Associations, and Neighborhoods, that's called Durham CAN, connected Smith with Reverend Prince Rivers, pastor at Union Baptist, after a conversation between Telemach and Rivers about how to support Durham's unhoused population. Rivers mentioned the school building, so Telemach connected the dots, knowing that the city was in desperate need for more shelter space. And Rivers says, I was just really excited about the opportunity because we do have this space. And I know that both my time here in Durham and my time pastoring in other cities, this is always an issue. What do you do for temporary housing in the winter for unhoused people? Often faith communities have space that is not used 24 hours a day, and so the opportunity to be a part of that seemed like a great initiative. Union Baptist Church will be able to provide 52 beds at their school building at 311 Dowd Street. The city is contracting with Families Moving Forward, a local charity, to staff the shelter. The congregation at Union Baptist is roughly 4,000 strong, says Rivers, and they are fervent about doing their part to support neighbors in need. Rivers said, when I announced we were doing this on the Sunday before Thanksgiving, there was roaring applause from the congregation. They know there's a need, and even though the hands-on volunteer opportunities may be limited, we continue to get calls almost every other day from people who are trying to see if they can volunteer. Adding 50-plus beds in one location is a unique challenge and a win worth celebrating for Smith and his team. Many other churches that have answered the call to open temporary shelters don't have working sprinkler systems, and that caps the number of people they can house at 20 due to fire code building safety. Creating space for 54 beds through Union Baptist has enabled us to do something we have not been able to do in years past, Smith says. Bringing more folk under one roof is more efficient because it allows the same number of overnight staff to support a greater number of folks seeking the shelter. In addition to those 52 beds provided by Union, Asbury United Methodist Church is making 20 new beds available in partnership with the Open Table Ministry, and Durham Crisis Response Center is adding 3 beds. To get the word out about available beds on White Flag Nights, organizers disseminate information through places like churches and libraries that are already frequented by the homeless population. And folks in need of shelter can also call Entry Point Durham to locate a shelter with an open bed. Still, Leah Gladlin, Durham Community Safety Coordinator, says only about 70% of White Flag beds get filled, despite the need. In response, the city launched a separate triage hotline. First response hospital workers, street outreach organizers can call to get real-time shelter availability for individuals they encounter. Before the hotline, if someone didn't show up to take a bed they reserved, shelters and outreach groups did not have a cohesive way to backfill the bed. Smith notes that some unhoused folks do not want or don't feel safe in a congregate setting, which is what most shelters have to offer. In lieu of shelter, the city's HURT team and other outreach groups pass out blankets, sleeping bags, jackets, and survival kits that Smith says are designed to help keep people warm who may, either by choice or absence of options, choose to sleep outdoors. But those solutions are only a temporary fix. The face of homelessness is as diverse a mosaic as the broader community. Families with young children, the formerly incarcerated, the elderly, people with pets. Many unhoused folks are working as they bounce from shelter to shelter, whether outdoors in a tent, in car, or temporary housing. And as the cost of living rises, folks are finding it harder to keep pace. Tillamook spent 16 years with Durham Public Schools as a classroom teacher and learning coach. She stepped into that lead organizer role at CAN in 2022 after witnessing too many students dealing with housing insecurity. She said, "I was on the front line with students, and sometimes when they come to the classroom, everything they deal with outside, they bring in, and it prevents them from being successful. Seeing students who are unsheltered, who are dealing with those types of dynamics, I was like, what systems can really help parents who are struggling?" In the future, organizers and public officials hope to increase capacity by leveraging unused public land like former school buildings. Smith and Tillamook said they've had conversations with DPS leadership about potential opportunities. Another priority is building a day shelter in Durham, which Tillamook says is, quote, desperately needed. Day shelters don't just provide space for folks. They are a way station for essential services. For example, at Oak City Cares, folks can take a shower, do laundry, get health screenings, use a computer, and even grab a meal on the weekends. Those services are more disjointed in Durham, but an increase in available facilities, especially those that can house a higher volume of people, would allow the city's resources to stretch even further. Smith says, "We looked over at Raleigh and Wake County, and they were spending about the same amount as we were, but they were getting like 5 times as many White Flag beds out of it. Part of that They had a more robust partnership with their faith community, and they had been able to find buildings that allowed them to hold larger emergency shelters. So part of our strategy was, let's start working locally. We're not going to get everywhere we want to be this winter season, but let's see if we can make real progress toward finding larger spaces in partnership with faith communities and other organizations. United Way of the Triangle has stepped in to manage the fundraising campaign as part of the 100 Days of Warmth. The extra funding would support warm meals and expanded capacity for White Flag shelters now and in the future. Smith says, "If we can show that we can generate meaningful private dollars, I think we have greater capacity to further expand these White Flag shelters, either as we go this season or as we head into next season, because we're generating this proof of concept," says Smith. And from Jasmine Gallup, today at Indie Week, after years spent moving around, the LGBT Center of Raleigh settles into a long-term space. After years of bouncing around downtown, operating out of storage units, and searching for a sustainable lease agreement, LGBT Center finally has a new home. A 3,000-square-foot community center on Cabarrus Street is a cozy, comfortable space, inviting you to sit and stay a while, perhaps curled up with one of the 5,000 or so LGBTQ-focused books that line the walls, or tucked into one of the two private nooks around back. Executive Director Corey Hennessy told the Indy, "One of the things we've recognized is not everybody feels like LGBT Center is a place for them, even if they are part of the community. Many view the center as a resource for people in crisis," Hennessy added, "for those who need food, housing, or help navigating government aid programs. And while the center does provide that," she said, they said, we also want to bring back the element of just having a nice, fun space to be in, creating that sense that this is a space for everyone." We caught up with Hennessy at the center's official ribbon-cutting December the 10th. The new and improved building is not just a refuge from icy December cold, but also the chilly political environment. Since Trump took office again in January, anti-trans rhetoric has heated up, and new policies have targeted LGBTQ-affirming programs and resources. The center offers a truly safe space where LGBTQ folks can express themselves and connect with others without fear of personal or professional repercussions. Past the lounge and library, one of the largest LGBTQ book collections in the Southeast, which includes a children's section, is a small cyber center with desktops. People can use them for anything they might need, whether that's applying for jobs or connecting with family and friends, said Hennessy during a media tour. Tucked against the wall is a harm reduction kiosk. That's a vending machine that dispenses critical resources like emergency contraceptives and Narcan instead of salty snacks. Although these and other items like deodorant are available elsewhere, the center offers them free of cost and judgment. Around the back, staff are still building up the center's food pantry with shelf-stable items. They're also working to add more garments to the free clothing closet, which includes gender-affirming items like chest binders and shapewear, said Hennessy. Opposite the staff offices and conference room is a shelf full of grab-and-go care packages with items like soap and earplugs. The center is still a work in progress, but in the heart of downtown, just a few blocks from Raleigh's main bus station, it's once again a visible part of the community. Longtime Raleighites might remember the LGBTQ Center's old building in the Warehouse District on Harrington Street. Hennessy has fond memories of the space, which they worked in for 5 years before the owner sold that building. They said, "I'm truly a product of the center. I came for the first time when I was questioning my identity and I needed community. I quickly started volunteering and I was able to connect with people and started just coming out of my shell. I met some amazing, wonderful folks that are still part of my life. Since Harrington Street site closed in 2018, the center has rented office space and held programs all over Raleigh. In 2020, when the COVID pandemic hit, the center moved to mostly virtual programming, slowly resuming in-person meetings in recent years. Hennessy told Indy, "For about 5 years, people were like, 'The center doesn't exist anymore. They really thought we had just disappeared.'" They added, "Finding the Cabarrus Street was a huge relief. I saw so much potential for this space and just more stability, which was something we've needed for a really long time." Going from leasing to opening was an arduous 2-year journey. However, the historic building, which once served as a jukebox cellar and later a record store, among other things, needed new floors, renovated bathrooms, updated plumbing and electrical, and a modern HVAC system. And as he said, realizing the amount of work that needed to be done to make it usable really quickly became overwhelming. Fortunately, the center received significant support from the community, including a $300,000 donation from local contracting company, Cooper Tasia. Now 2 days into a 5-year lease with options to renew, Hennessy said the center can expect to stay put until at least 2038. And it feels like there's a bright future ahead. There was plenty of pomp and circumstance as the center welcomed guests for the first time. But after the photo ops ended, the speeches wrapped, community members piled into the lounge for a preview night party. Filled with laughter, conversation, and cheerful holiday music, the center quickly became the home Hennessy hoped for. They said during their speech, "I am so grateful there are so many people in this room I know from different places and different walks of life. Having community is one of the most important things that LGBTQ folks just really need." That closes the column itself, but there's this postscript. The center is currently open for volunteering and appointments. It will be closed from December 22nd through January the 2nd for the holidays, December 22 through January 2. Drop-in hours are from 12 to 6 p.m. Wednesday through Friday, and on Saturday 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., and those hours are expected to start in mid-January. And finally, the center is currently seeking donations of shelf-stable foods and hygiene items. Monetary donations are also welcome. To give or for more information, visit the LGBT Center of Raleigh's website, the City of Raleigh's website, LGBT Center, or you can email info@LGBTCenterOfRaleigh.com. info@LGBTCenterOfRaleigh.com. Next, our front page, as it will, article, "Months After Chantal, Some Duramites' Homes Are Barely Habitable." When Tropical Storm Chantal hit Durham July 6th, 77-year-old Fred Foster lost nearly everything. His military uniforms washed down the Eno River. His dream Mercedes submerged, completely unusable. His home, close to $100,000 in damages. 5 months later, Foster and his wife are living on the second floor of his home because the first floor remains gutted and uninhabitable. Even though he paid off his home 10 years ago, he's once again in debt from a disaster recovery loan from the Federal Small Business Administration. And despite applying for a state grant specifically for victims of Chantal, he has yet to receive that money. Foster, a retired NC Department of Motor Vehicles employee and former county commissioner, says, "We were ready to relax and enjoy our lives. House was paid for. We pay our expenses out of our retirement Social Security. Then all of a sudden, the house is empty. Everything you paid for and put in here is gone. Now we're on our own." Over 50 homes in North Durham's Old Farm, a 470-home neighborhood where Foster has resided since 1985, were flooded in that storm. Now around 20 of those remain damaged, and their owners, those who, like Foster, lacked flood insurance, are unable to complete the necessary repairs. They have sought help, but 5 months after the storm, they are still waiting. Residents want help rebuilding their damaged homes and answers on why disaster assistance has been so slow. They also want to know how the city and state plan to handle the next destructive storm. Foster has grown exasperated by the government's inaction, wondering, "Why are you guys not willing to help us out?" He also worries about the future. What can you do to help mitigate these problems so folks don't have to continue to rebuild and borrow money? The Old Farm neighborhood is a quiet suburban neighborhood across Roxborough Street from West Point on the Eno City Park. A predominantly black neighborhood, it includes a mix of multifamily condo complexes and brick and paneled single-family homes dating from the 1960s and 70s. When Chantel hit, nearly 80 individuals were evacuated from Old Farm by boat. Waters nearly reached the ceilings inside some homes, and streets looked like lakes. Immediately after the storm, charities like the Red Cross, Baptist on a Mission, Day One Relief helped residents get basic goods, supplying clothes, dehumidifiers, and removing moldy furniture. City and county officials, including the city manager, went to impacted neighborhoods and surveyed damage. Various government entities have stepped up since, but residents say their efforts have often fallen short. In late July, the city of Durham and Durham County opened a disaster recovery center at the North Regional Library, where residents could apply for federal Small Business Administration low-interest disaster loans, though in August, the center permanently closed. That same month, the state made grants available to individuals affected by Chantel, but the grant monies have yet to arrive in Old Farm. Meanwhile, unlike in past disasters, no federal grants were made available for individuals who suffered damage from Chantel. 5 months after the storm, the residents of Old Farm have been tangled in bureaucracy and are now victims of government finger-pointing. Chantel, a tropical storm, not a hurricane, has been overshadowed by the terrible destruction of Hurricane Helene in 2024. Chantel inflicted terrific concentrated damage, but affected fewer people and cost millions, compared to Helene's nearly $60 billion. On August 5th, Josh Stein declared Chantel a state disaster and activated state grants for individuals affected by the storm. The state also requested public assistance from the federal government. A month later, Trump administration finally declared Chantel a major disaster, unlocking $32 million in aid. However, the federal dollars will only reimburse municipalities and counties for emergency money already spent, not individuals. State Senator Sophia Chitlick, who represents Old Farm and much of Durham County, criticized the Chantel response by Federal Emergency Management Agency, which canceled $11 billion in disaster payments to states in October and faces reduced funding in the Trump administration's proposed budget. Chitlick said, "In Fran, you had immediate money to go out because it was FEMA money. But for Chantel, the state had to essentially stand up our own systems. And the reason the state had to step up in that way was because FEMA was not responding." Mayor Leonardo Williams of Durham agrees. "After Fran, FEMA conducted damage assessment and provided funding for buyouts. After Chantel, the city and county handled much of the disaster response coordination, including opening a disaster recovery center. And they said, this is really about the inaction of the federal government. Local governments are left without the capacity to address these things. That's really frustrating. In response to an email from the Ninth Street Journal, a FEMA spokesman stated, federal assets are only used when a governor requests them from FEMA because state assets are overwhelmed. Gerard Hamlick, a FEMA spokesperson, North Carolina did not request individual assistance for Durham County following Chantel. Public assistance was requested and approved. Brian Haynes, a spokesperson for NC Department of Public Safety, agrees the state did not ask for personnel for FEMA immediately after the storm. Haynes said all disasters begin and end locally in North Carolina. What this means is if an event is larger than local response can handle, they request assistance. If the state lacks the resource to manage the event, it then requests assistance from FEMA. In the case of Chantal, the state did not need any resources from FEMA for the response. Individual assistance from FEMA is only available for storms that damage at least 500 homes. Chantal didn't meet that threshold, so the state did not request individual assistance, said Haynes. So this time around, unlike after Hurricane Fran, the city cannot use federal dollars to purchase impacted homes from residents. To Senator Chitlick, those FEMA rules are part of the problem. She said FEMA should be providing cash assistance and low interest loans. They're not. They're not showing up in a disaster when Americans need them. Without federal aid, many residents are either staying and hoping for approval for state assistance grants, or they're trying to sell their homes on the private market. One group of residents fared better. They weren't spared from the storm, but because they had flood insurance, they received payouts from insurance companies to start reconstruction. Those residents' front yards display signs of from contractors advertising repairs. Yet only about 30% of the impacted old farm families had flood insurance before Chantal, says Neighborhood Association President Trey Gilmore. Mortgage companies require flood insurance for homes in a 100-year floodplain. The state, in partnership with FEMA, decides which homes meet that definition, creating maps that show flood risk, and FEMA provides final approval for the maps. The Eno River runs directly parallel to Old Farm, with some neighborhood homes within 100 feet of the riverbank. Nevertheless, FEMA maps classify only a small portion of Old Farm homes as being in a 100-year floodplain, also known as a special flood hazard area. Neighboring homes that appear equidistant from the river have different statuses. For example, one home on Hedgerow Place is considered minimal risk, while another home across the street is classified as within the 100-year plain. The Old Farm maps, like all Durham County floodplain maps, were last updated in 2018. Congress requires the federal government review national flood maps every 5 years, but it need not update them that frequently. Hammack referred questions about the maps to the state government. Brian Haynes, a spokesman for NC Department of Public Safety, said Durham floodplains maps are, quote, within the normal range for updates. Floodplain maps are updated on a 10 to 15 year cycle, and the next update is scheduled to begin in 2027 for the county, said Haynes. However, flood risks have risen as a result of a warming climate, said Miyuki Hino, an associate professor of city and regional planning at UNC Chapel Hill. As a result, areas outside the 100-year floodplains are flooding more frequently, and floodplain maps are quickly outdated. Hino said, warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. The amount of rain we see in more extreme rainfall events is going up. Chantal is a good example of that. Climate change is a factor that should push us collectively to invest in maps and updating often. from Foster's side yard. The Inner River is almost in view, barely obscured by a row of trees. Chantal marked the second time that the river overflowed following a storm, causing major flooding for Foster and his neighbors. In 1996, Hurricane Fran caused floodwaters to reach Foster's doorstep, forcing him to replace his waterlogged car. Flood insurance is one way homeowners can be made whole after a disaster. In other cases, the government has stepped in and bought property that's at high risk of repeated flooding. That happened after Hurricane Fran, when the city of Durham purchased some old farm homes with federal funding. Foster reached out to the city to see if his home could be acquired also. The answer was no. A 1999 letter from the city's Department of Public Works says the NC Division of Environmental Management, quote, calculated the ratio of benefits to cost for purchasing homes and recommended which homes at high risk of flooding should be purchased. 19 homes were on that list. Foster's was not one. While this home was not purchased, two neighboring houses were, the house two doors down and a house diagonally across the street. The empty lots where their homes once stood are now part of Old Farm Park. If Foster walks out to get the mail, he sees parkland where he once saw neighbors' houses. The North Carolina Division of Emergency Management, that's a division of the Department of Public Safety now, oversees buyouts following disasters. The department, which is legally required to retain records for only 7 years after it closes a case, closed out its Hurricane Fran response in 2003. It can't explain why Foster's home wasn't purchased back in the 1990s, except that North Carolina typically relies on those 100-year flood marks for buyouts. Haynes said, at best, I could say that whatever flood zone the home was in was above that 100-year mark, which is 2 feet above flood level. For 38-year-old resident Shala Perla, Chantal brought up nightmarish memories from Hurricane Floyd, which flooded her hometown, Tarboro, and neighboring Princeville, when she was just 12 years old. I was around my son age, said Perla. Floyd flooded out our school, our town, Princeville. Everything was gone. Chantal triggered me a bit because I was like, oh no, what is this going to look like? Many predominantly black North Carolina communities like Princeville were built on low-lying land, vulnerable to floods. Old Farm, built in 1967, became a refuge for many middle-class families moving away from historically black neighborhoods broken up by urban renewal. Gilmore said this was a special neighborhood. He grew up in Old Farm and moved back to raise his own family here. You could send your kids out to play, no matter where they are, because you know someone is watching them. Everyone knew each other. Perla was able to repair her home. When she moved in 2021, her home was classified as being in the 100-year plan, and her mortgage company required her to purchase flood insurance. She filed a claim shortly after the disaster and is nearly finished with repairs. She's glad she can stay in Old Farm, but she worries that other residents without insurance may be forced to sell because they can't afford repairs. She said the neighborhood's worth saving. Black folks have worked this land for generations. People have been here 30, 40 years. That's legacy. That's roots. 5 Old Farm residents have already put their homes up for sale, said Gilmore. Foster will not be one of them. And he said, if I could get enough money, I'd leave. But we'd never get any value out of the house now with its history. Foster took off his glasses and wiped his eyes. Many in the neighborhood, including Foster, are elderly and on fixed incomes. But even younger folks like 41-year-old Morgan Fielding, a remote tech worker, are struggling. She's staring down up to $70,000 in repair costs for mold remediation, flooring, and other rebuilding costs. She also has not received any grant money from the NC Department of Public Safety, which would only provide up to $43,600 if approved in full. Chitlick, who worked with the governor to establish these Chantal grants, acknowledges the state funds are not sufficient and that families need more help. She said, obviously, many families have lost significantly more than that, and we need to keep fighting to make them whole. Well, the rollout process for these state individual grants has been rife with delays. Fielding applied by the original deadline August 10 and was promised a response within 4 to 6 weeks. After 6 weeks, she reached back out to Department of Emergency Management and was told to wait another 45 days. Originally, Fielding says, her state caseworker told her to submit 2 contractors' quotes for renovation costs, itemized by material. But in October, she was told those quotes needed to be itemized by room. She was also told for the first time to submit proof that insurance had denied her claim, despite not having flood insurance in the first place. Foster has experienced similar delays. In October, he learned that none of the residents' W-9s were correctly processed, and they needed to resubmit them. A department spokesman said the State Department of Emergency Management is still processing 86 recovery grant applications, and there's still no date from when the money will be released. Haynes said, we often have back and forth with the applicants. We do understand it can be confusing for some people, especially during an event where they are under a lot of stress, which is why we encourage applicants to be in touch with their case managers. Pardon me. The legislature's failure to pass a budget also slowed relief efforts, said Chitlick. She's pushing for more disaster relief in the next state budget, including money for future disasters. She also wants the state to provide mitigation grants, traditionally a responsibility of FEMA, to potentially buy out properties in Old Farm and River Forest. That's another Durham neighborhood damaged by Chantal. The city has also begun long-term planning for future disasters and is making infrastructure updates to reduce flooding risk starting downtown, said Williams. There are currently no projects slated for Old Farms. Chitlick said, this is nobody's fault and everybody's responsibility. There's limited precedent for state buyouts, but we are not going to leave Old Farm and River Forest behind. Foster is still waiting for state grant money. Meanwhile, one thing has changed for him. He now has flood insurance. When the maps of Durham County were redrawn, Foster's home was reclassified and found to be within the floodplain, but Foster didn't know that. The city of Durham and Durham County send out letters to homeowners when floodplain boundaries change, but Foster doesn't remember receiving such a letter. He found out about the reclassification only after Chantal struck, when he received a new letter from the city stating his home was in the floodplain. When he applied for an SBA loan to help with damage, the small business required him to get flood insurance. It was the first time any agency made that request in the 40 years he lived in Old Farm. Eno thinks more homeowners should be purchasing flood insurance, like Fred. Quote, no matter how good our maps are never a perfect indicator of risk. Everyone should have flood insurance no matter where you live. Foster raised his family in Old Farm. He had his dream life and dream car. Then came Chantal, forcing him to start over from scratch. He said, I knew this was where we were going to live or die. Now going down the street brings tears to my eyes. Next, another tropical storm, Chantal's story. At the river's edge. Early in this year's hurricane season, if such a designation still exists, given the increase in frequency and severity of storms, tropical storm Chantal swept into North Carolina with devastating, record-setting rainfall. 4 counties, Alamance, Chatham, Orange, and Moore, declared states of emergency, and at least 6 people died in storm-related deaths. The seemingly relentless rain fell fast, saturating some areas with nearly 12 inches of water in 24 hours. The Eno and Haw both rose to levels not seen since 1996's Hurricane Fran, and Saxable Haw a revitalized mill town of about 1,300 people, Caitlin Sweat, like many of her neighbors, watched the Haw River's rising waters through the night. At the time, she lived in the River Mill Apartments, a renovated former cotton mill that consists of two big buildings, one a former spinning mill and the other a dye house, both of which are located on the river's banks. With the water rising, a tall friend evacuated her by piggy bank through floodwaters that were already waist high. A dancer and sound artist, Sweat is the managing and development director at Culture Mill, a performing arts organization that has been part of the Saxapaha community since the nonprofit was founded in 2017. The Culture Mill Lab, located across the street, was on higher ground than her apartment, so Sweat went there with other evacuees, texting updates on the storm to friends and colleagues. One of those friends was Leah Clayton, whose partner is Paperhand Puppet Project's executive director and co-founder Donovan Zimmerman. From her vantage point, Sweat could see Paperhand's studio, which lies even closer to the river edge than Sweat's mill apartment. I called and told them the river was rising, and they said, let us know if it reaches the door. I texted them a picture, said, I'm so sorry, it reached the door, which meant water was in their space. And by the time Zimmerman arrived, the river had crested and the waters began to recede. People were already at the studio, moving wet puppets out of the mud into the parking lot, hoping they'd dry in the sun. Made of papier-mâché, cardboard, bamboo, and other delicate materials, these puppets are not only works of art, but essential components of Paperhand's large-scale, multidisciplinary performances. Zimmerman says, we lost a lot of tools, a lot of fabric, and a lot of the older puppets we were planning to reuse. We also lost some of the ones that were going to be in our new show, a show about rivers and the power of water. That show, their 25th annual summer performance at Chapel Hill's Forest Theater, was just a little over a month away. Entitled The Gift, the show centers on grandmothers and women's guardians of waterways, invoking the movement, spirit, and power of water with awe-inspiring puppets that include a 60-foot ocean goddess, a river, and an illuminated whale. Zimmerman said, none of it was lost on us about how close to home it all was. The storm damage forced both Culture Mill and Paperhand to vacate their long-held studio spaces. Fortunately for Paperhand, plans for a move were already in the works before Chantal. The communal scale of the art and the number of volunteers necessary to make it, not to mention the archive of past puppets, needed more room. The new space, a warehouse, still in Saxapaha, but a bit further out, was secured, but the move was not to take place until after the big summer show. Of course, that, like so many things, changed with Chantal. Heather Lagarde serves as president of Paperhand Puppet Project. The timing could not have been more difficult, she said. She owns the Haw River Ballroom, located in the mill's former dye house, and is well known for her active role in supporting the Saxapaha arts. She and husband Tom Lagarde started the popular Saturdays in Saxapaha series and noted for providing a center for relief efforts after Chantal. And yes, she's a friend of this writer. Good luck finding an arts reporter in the area who doesn't know Heather. Paperhand's move was difficult and rushed, volunteers and staff evacuating what they could from the old space as quickly as possible so they could get back to working on the new show. And despite the chaos, come August, the gift took place as planned. Lagarde said, watching people reach up for the lit-up whale puppet as they came up the steps of the Forest Theater was incredible. Little kids that parents are holding up, older people, teenagers, all had this look of amazement on their faces. I'm just so grateful we were able to keep Paperhand in Saxapaha. It would have been terrible if the flood had driven them out. To be able to pivot like that and speak to real climate disaster and resilience when it has actually completely impacted you in all your work for the whole year, is one of the gifts of art. At Culture Mill, meanwhile, the question of real estate became, well, more of a question. Since 2017, the nonprofit has rented its space, using it as a creative laboratory for practices, rehearsals, office programs, and artist residencies. The building's dampness, which had always been a concern. "I would tell people the walls cry when it rains," Sweat joked, after the storm felt and smelled like it needed major remediation. Well, for Tommy Noonan, who serves as co-director of Culture Mill with his partner Muriel Elizeon, staying in the space felt like an uphill battle. With climate change, more severe rain and floods would come, and making the building safe would require resources, especially if there was health hazardous mold, which seemed to be the case. Noonan said, "We can't ethically practice community care and invite folks in or use it ourselves if that's the situation." Instead of rushing to find a new space, the organization opted to do what is at the core of their mission: create the conditions for artistic practice by being in the body and the present conditions of a place. Elizeon said, "Even inside this decision-making, it's process-based practice. Instead of jumping into the conclusion, we need to lean into the unknown. We don't know yet what is coming, but we know what we're committed to." Taking time to decide what the organization most needed to continue its work, which includes several ongoing collaborations with longtime partners like the American Dance Festival and Carolina Performing Arts, and to secure its future in an increasingly perilous world due to both environmental catastrophe and defunding of the arts, Culture Mill came to an interesting conclusion: give up a physical space entirely. Noonan said, "A physical space is not the core of what we are as Culture Mill. It's been an important anchor, a way to anchor our values, but it's not what we're based on. We're based on the work that we do and our relationships." As of December the 1st, Culture Mill is nomadic. Instead of having a designated space for their work and their artists, they will be operating out of the spaces of their many collaborators. Being nomadic and working intermittently out of Haw River Ballroom is, for Culture Mill, a return to the organization's origins. When the group first began, it had its headquarters in the ballroom. An early project was called Trust the Bus, wherein audience members would board a donated, renovated school bus for site-specific music and dance performances at undisclosed locations. Getting locals to participate was part of the project, and together, artists and audience would share an experience of art and geography that helped join them as a community. The ride sounds not unlike where Cultural Mill is now, only instead of trusting the bus, they have to trust the network of support they've built around them over the last decade. Noonan says, "We have always been rooted in the place of Saxapahaw, but also in this fluid movement between Saxapahaw and international collaborations, artists coming here, us going elsewhere. That sense of fluidity, along with the organization's demonstrated ability to remain flexible in difficult times, will be useful as it moves forward without a fixed address. Prioritizing people and envisioning relationships as a resource more important than real estate is Culture Mill's response to Chantal. And cultivating that community of care is part of the organization's work. This fall, they begin a new series of workshops that are held at Haw River Ballroom and focus on building community resilience. The first workshop, entitled Processing Chantal, Embodied Integration of the Flood. As any ecologist can tell you, the health of one ecosystem impacts the ones around it, and that sort of interconnectedness has long been part of life in Saxapa Hall. The folks at Culture Mill often use the word ecosystem to describe the work they do, envisioning their role to be that of a mill, hence the name, operating with a circular exchange of bringing in many components, people, ideas, resources, energy, and then sharing them. Art, as they see it, isn't not a linear transaction, a relational one, grounded in the community that creates it. To cover the costs incurred from the storm's damage and the unplanned move, Paperhand created a GoFundMe campaign to raise $100,000 and was able to make that goal. Even though community support swelled during storm recovery, Lagarde, who sits on the board of directors for Culture Mill as well as Paperhand, is worried that both organizations will have a difficult year ahead of them. Storm recovery aside, all arts organizations and nonprofits are feeling the economic pinch of the federal government's massive cuts. Lagarde said, with Paperhand, it feels like, okay, they're in a space, they're safe, they've had to adjust, and there's been a lot of going on, but it should work out for the best. With Culture Mill, it's still unknown where or how they will land. They're having to navigate these waters very differently. Navigating the waters is something we all have to get better at. It's a necessary skill beyond arts nonprofits in river towns. After Chantal, the North Carolina State Climate Office at NC State University published an account of the activity that ends with this sentence, quote, climatology tells us that the coastal plain is a common target for hurricanes, and after last fall's hard hit from Hurricane Helene in the mountains and Chantal's heavy rain and flooding in the Piedmont and Sandhills, it's clearer now than ever that nowhere in the state is immune to tropical impacts. Nowhere in the state is immune, and if you haven't already been affected by a storm, you probably will be soon. Resilience is the ability to adapt to adversity. But what is recovery? Is it simply a matter of repairing old buildings, putting people back in them? Or is it recognizing that the landscape around us has irrevocably changed, and maybe we need to do things differently? For both Culture Mill and Paperhand, Chantel's destruction of their physical space brought hardship along with complex feelings of grief and uncertainty, and renewed appreciation for the safety and support of their community. It wasn't about reassembling to recreate what existed before, or throwing out a few puppets and moving on, but instead has become an ongoing opportunity to grow and change in new ways. Zimmerman had this to say, we are left feeling strong and supported and held by our community here, and that's a good place to move from when you're doing art on a communal scale like this. Before the flood, we had more than 300 volunteers come by the studio to help papier-mâché and sew and do other projects. I see that number only increasing as we go forward in the new space. Ultimately, Zimmerman said he came to view the experience as the river, sort of reaching up and teaching us a hard lesson, but a powerful one, that letting go is just part of the journey. Well, I believe I have a little bit of time enough to read the article about Durham High School's drama takes the spotlight. If you want to see the future of the arts, you don't need to head to New York or Los Angeles. You just need to attend a local high school theater performance. Earlier this fall, one such local production received its flowers in the form of a surprise message from actor Lawrence Fishburne. In November, the Hollywood icon who played Dr. Larrabee in the 2006 film Aquila and the Bee sent Hillside High School's drama department a personal good luck note, thanking them for bringing the Aquila story to the stage. Hillside's production, which closed on November 9th, honored the film's legacy while giving young performers space to shine. Hillside Theater Director Tiffany Agerston said, what's happening on the school's stage is rooted in something deeper, a creative community built across generations. Agustin herself is a graduate of Hillside, where she studied under Wendell Tabb, the high school's beloved Tony Award-winning teacher. Tabb also taught Agustin's mother in his first Hillside production back in 1987. Agustin said, Hillside's theater program is a community that spans generations. Families keep coming back, telling their children and their friends, you need to be a part of this. That legacy shapes who we are. Across town, Durham School of the Arts saw tickets for its teen edition of Hadestown sell out in just 25 minutes. The production, which ran November 12th to 14th, drew so much demand the school created a wait list to accommodate eager audiences. And at Jordan High School, the drama department is making waves, for it's the first high school in the country to stage Water for Elephants. It's a musical adaptation of a best-selling 2006 novel. The production earned support from Broadway professionals, including the story's original scriptwriter, Rick Elise, and members of Pigpen Theater Company, which helped refine elements of the show. Jordan Theater Director Olivia Bellido first connected with Broadway licensing last year while in New York to accept the Stephen Schwartz Musical Theater Teacher of the Year Award. When representatives of Water for Elephants mentioned they were looking for a school bold enough to pilot a high school adaptation of the script, which deals with mature themes like animal abuse and toxic relationships and involves complex choreography numbers, Bellido did not hesitate. Collectively, these productions point to something larger than any single show. They highlight a deeply rooted arts education ecosystem, one where students gain hands-on skills, students take creative risks, and communities show up. Tickets typically cost $10 to $20, making these performances accessible entry points into the Triangle's rich arts scene. And in Durham, every high school is required to have both a theater teacher and a theater tech teacher, underscoring the district commitment to building pathways for young artists. Well, folks, the music tells me that my dramatic recitations do you have to cease. For this year, this calendar year, I will not be back until after the new year, as the studio itself will be closed on next Wednesday, I believe, through the 2nd of January. Well, podcast section of the ncreadingservice.org, that's your website, will have this and other broadcasts from Indie Week, the Independent, and John Federson, that's me, will be on some of them reading. Well, I hope you have a lovely Hanukkah and a Christmas holiday or whatever it is you choose to celebrate this year. And a happy New Year's. And we'll be back for the Indie Week next year.